Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Tuesday's edition of Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. Melody will return to the airwaves next week. For all your gold and silver needs, call us toll-free at 1-800-375-4188. For the next hour, I'll be bringing you my opinion and commentary on the economic and political news of the day. Tuesday, March 21, 2023. Happy second day of spring. And happy National Common Courtesy Day. Let's celebrate this important concept by inviting all listeners to send us any concerns you have today that you'd like us to talk about on some future program. Email me what's on your mind at daveallen.usa@yahoo.com. That's Dave Allen, A-L-L-E-N, one word, .usa@yahoo.com. I'll read any responses on Thursday's Financial Survival program. Thanks. Well, let's get started with today's market report. It was certainly a day of profit-taking for gold, silver, and other precious metal investors. As we speak, gold down in the New York spot aftermarket, $38 and change, almost 2% at $1,941. Silver still in the $22 range, down 1%, roughly 20 cents at $22.44. Platinum down 2%, 19 bucks at $981. And palladium down 1.25%, 17 bucks at $1,475. Now, that's despite a slight fall in the U.S. dollar index, which was down 0.7. Actually, that looks like 0.07 of a point today at 103.21. Now, oil actually headed up today for the first time, up almost 3% at $69.50 a barrel. Natural gas up almost 4% at 2.307. We got the bond market positive day. In terms of yields, I should say, that's not good for the par value of those bonds. The 10-year yield up 0.12 at 3.6%. Still a big inversion. 2-year yield up 0.251 at 4.18% roughly, and the 90-day or 3-month T-bill up 0.027 at 4.75, both under 5% now, but still a good chunk ahead of that 10-year, signaling, continuing to signal a coming recession. Now, in the paper markets, really just the Nikkei down nationwide today, or internationally speaking. Here in the States, you got the Dow Jones up about 1%, 316 points, close at 32,560 and change. The NASDAQ up 1.5%, 184 points. At 11,860, and the broader S&P 500 up 1.3%, 51 points and change at, we'll call it 4,003. And that, ladies and gentlemen, we'll call it a day for the discount gold and silver trading market report. Now, in the news, sales of previously owned homes rose almost 15% last month compared with January, according to the National Association of Realtors. That puts sales at an annualized rate of almost 4.6 million units. Again, previously owned home. It was the first monthly gain in a year and the largest increase since July 2020. Sales, however, were almost 23% lower than they were in February of a year ago. Now, these sales counts are based on closings, so the contracts were likely signed at the end of December and into January when mortgage rates had fallen sharply. The average rate on the popular 30-year fixed loan hovered in the low 6% range throughout January, after reaching a high of 7% plus last fall. You know, the relative drop caused a jump in sales of newly built homes before rates jumped back towards 7% last month. They now stand at 6.67%, according to Mortgage News Daily. The realtor's chief economist, Lawrence Yun, said, conscious of changing mortgage rates, home buyers are taking advantage of any rate declines. Moreover, he continued, we're seeing stronger sales gains in areas where home prices are decreasing and local economies are adding jobs. Mortgage rates, higher mortgage rates have been cooling home prices since last summer, and for the first time in a record 131 consecutive months, that's almost 11 years, prices were lower on a year-over-year basis. Median price of an existing home sold in February was $363,000. That's down about 0.2% from February 2022. Now, that lower median price could be a sign that homes on the more affordable end of the market are selling. Sales might have even been higher were it not for what is still very low supply out there. There are just 980,000 homes for sale at the end of February, according to the realtors, about the same as January. So at the current sales price, that represents a 2.6-month supply. The balanced market between buyer and seller is considered 4 to 6 months. Yun added that inventory levels are still at historic lows, consequently, multiple offers are returning on a good number of properties. This could start to heat up prices again, but with mortgage rates now higher than they were in January, it's going to be harder for some buyers to compete. All cash sales accounted for 28% of transactions in February. Individual investors returned, making up 18% of buyers compared with 16% in January. when looking at sales at different price points. They were all down in the range of 20% from a year ago, with sales down the most in the top $1 million plus segment. Oh, what does it all mean? The past week, the past few weeks, all the reports up, down, all around. Well, as of earlier today, about 83% of Fed fund future traders believe the Fed will indeed raise rates tomorrow by a quarter point, but clearly also faces the tough task of reassuring markets it can stem a worse banking crisis. Traders and economists mostly expect the Fed to increase the Fed funds target rate to a range of 4.75% to 5%, although about 17% expect the Fed to pause its hiking because of its concerns about the banking system. The Fed's contemplating using its interest rate tools. At the same time, it's trying to soothe markets to stop further bank runs. And that fear is that rising rates could further put pressure on banking institutions and crimp lending even further, hurting particularly small businesses and other borrowers. Economist Michael Gapin at the Too Big to Fail Bank of America says the Fed will have to explain its double barrel policy. We'll see to what extent Chairman Powell decides to be straight with us as opposed to engaging in Fed speak. Gapin says you have to show you can walk and chew gum at the same time, using your lender of last resort powers to quell any fears about deposit flights at medium-sized banks. Federal regulators stepped in to guarantee deposits at the failed Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank, and they provided more favorable loans to banks for a period of up to 1 year. And then the Fed joined with other global central banks on Sunday to enhance liquidity through the standing dollar swap system, making that available daily now instead of weekly, after UBS agreed to buy the embattled Credit Suisse for a net negative $14.2 billion. Actually, they paid about $3.2 billion in cash. Investors will be looking for assurances tomorrow from Fed Chair Powell that the Fed can indeed contain the banking problems. Gapin said, "We want to know it's really about a few idiosyncratic institutions and not a more pervasive problem with respect to the regional bank model. In these moments, the market needs to know you feel you understand the problem and that you're willing and capable of doing something about it." Well, I'm afraid that remains to be seen. Remember, this is a Fed that was convinced that inflation was just temporary. Now, markets have been whipsawed in the last month, literally. First by a hawkish-sounding Fed, and then by fears of contagion in this banking system of ours. Well, Fed officials began their two-day meeting today. The FOMC event kicks off just 2 weeks after Powell warned congressional committees that the Fed may have to hike rates even more than expected because of its battle with inflation. Of course, those comments sent interest rates in the secondary market particularly soaring. A few days later, the sudden collapse of Silicon Valley Bank stunned markets, sending bond yields dramatically lower. Expectations for Fed rate hikes also moved dramatically. What was expected to be a half-point hike just 2 weeks ago is now up for debate at a quarter point or even zero. Now, markets were calmer yesterday and today after UBS's agreement to buy its former rival Credit Suisse for, again, $3.25 billion in cash, which soothed some nerves about the banking system. But certainly worries remain. There's regional bank First Republic, which received deposits of $30 billion from a consortium of banks last week. JP Morgan Chase is reportedly working to help the bank find alternatives such as raising capital or even a sale. First Republic stock fell 47% yesterday, but rose again today with other regional banks after Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said the government could backstop deposits at other institutions if necessary. More on that in a moment. In fact, Melody's BFF, Treasury Secretary Yellen, said today the government is ready to provide further guarantees of deposits if the banking crisis indeed worsens. In a speech to the American Bankers Association, of all people, the former Fed chair said authorities believe they have taken appropriate actions to stem liquidity problems in that sector, but will do more if needed. Yellen said the steps we took were not focused on aiding specific banks or classes of banks. They weren't. Our intervention was necessary to protect the broader U.S. banking system. And similar actions, she added, could be warranted if smaller institutions suffer deposit runs that pose the risk of contagion. Again, her comments come in the wake of a couple of bank failures. Most notably, again, Silicon Valley and Signature Banks. Customers worry that liquidity problems caused by duration risk with the bank's holdings could cause similar institutions not to be able to meet deposit requirements. In response, regulators did say they would guarantee all deposits going beyond the previous 250,000 level for the two banks. Yellen's comments indicate that the authorities are prepared to do the same for other institutions if needed. One idea that reportedly has been floated is to offer a tiered pricing system with the FDIC, where depositors would pay extra to guarantee deposits above that $250,000 per account. Now, following the SVB and Signature collapses, the Treasury, Fed, and FDIC launched that two-prong initiative that allowed banks to meet their short-term borrowing needs. One of them, called the Bank Term Funding Program, provided one-year loans against safe securities at full face value, while the other expanded, pretty significantly expanded the Fed's discount window. Together, the programs helped assure that banks would be able to borrow to meet depositor withdrawals as confidence in the smaller banks waned. Yellen told bankers that the situation is stabilizing and the U.S. banking system remains sound. Yellen noted that regulators will be looking at whether stronger regulations will be needed to prevent a similar situation in the future. I mean, I think one thing that is probably a done deal, although anything being a done deal with this Congress is a bold question mark. But I think they're going to have to revisit their clawback of Dodd-Frank, where they took a lot of medium-sized banks, quote-unquote, off the table for their stress tests. Going $250 billion to $50 billion in assets, I think we're going to have to go back close to, if not at, $250 billion. Okay. Well, we see that more consumers are using credit for their household expenses. I'm talking about how and when they might need to take on more credit card debt to help ease the pain points of this bout of inflation, which remains stubbornly high and which continues to eat into household purchasing power. In a new report called New Reality Check by the company Payments and Lending Club, 4,200 consumers were surveyed to get a sense of the trade-offs between how they use credit and their savings. Roughly 60% of consumers said they're living paycheck to paycheck, and most of us think that inflation pressures will remain in place well into next year. While drilling down a bit, there has been a bit more prudent management of household debt. The report found that 7 in 10 customers report taking a range of approaches to manage their credit card debt. Hey! I hear some funky music. It can only mean one thing. Time for a break. Please stick around. We'll be back soon. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home. And if you ask me how I'm feeling, don't tell me you're too blind to see. Never gonna give you up, never gonna let you down, never gonna run around and desert you, never gonna make you cry, never gonna say goodbye, never gonna tell a lie.
Hey, welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen, 1-800-375-4188, or look us up on the web at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. Let's just break what we were talking about at the end of the first segment to conclusion. 42% of consumers in this payments survey said they're likely to take on more credit products in the coming year. A full half of those, 21%, say credit card debt tops that list. Now, the average consumer holds outstanding credit balances right now equivalent to 35% of their available savings. So that's approaching the danger level. Those living paycheck to paycheck tend to have higher credit card debt relative to their savings. Reports show that those with issues paying monthly bills carry balances of 157% of their available savings, meaning they would still have a balance even if they emptied their savings account. Hang in there, ladies and gentlemen. Now it's time for this week's Levity is Golden. If your diet consists of an occasional stop for fast food, you need to listen to this one. A new study shows that the average price for a McDonald's Big Mac in the U.S. is now $5.15, or nearly 22% more than the pre-pandemic era, a new study shows. Wow, that's a lot of lettuce. Although I will say, I mean, $5.15, still not bad for a what amounts essentially for a double cheeseburger. I know the restaurant, I'm meeting some friends for dinner after today's program, has that classic cheddar and beef for $12.95. So pick your poison, right? The Iconic Burger's price varies from state to state, of course, with a Big Mac in Hawaii fetching the most here, a whopping $5.31. That's according to CashNet USA. New York's the next most expensive state, $5.23, followed by Jersey at $5.19. And California at a, well, bargain of $5.11. Out of the more than 13,000 Mickey D's in the U.S., those in Mississippi were found to have the cheapest Big Macs at $3.91. After Mississippi, the best bang for your buck can be found nearby in Arkansas with the Big Mac available for $3.95, while Alabama, Missouri, and South Dakota tied for the third cheapest at $3.99. Middle American states like Iowa, Kansas, Nebraska, and Oklahoma all listed the Big Mac at $4.07. Good to know what will be fueling the upcoming presidential campaign stops. Big Mac prices in Europe are as high as $7.75 in Switzerland and I forget the other country, $7.13 in France and $6.88 in Norway. And they're as low as $2.73 in Ukraine. Not surprising there. $2.36 in Brazil, $2.12 in Egypt, and a whopping $1.91 in Pakistan. Of course, these prices are a far cry from the 45-cent Big Mac that originally was rolled out when it made its debut in 1967 in my home state of Pennsylvania. Burgers' rising costs has been fueled by inflation, of course, which currently remains stubbornly high at 6%, three times higher than the Federal Reserve's 2% target. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is this week's Levity is Golden. Now, one of the big questions to emerge from the visit by China's President Xi Jinping to Moscow this week is the degree to which it could help a geopolitically isolated Russia and Vladimir Putin. Putin, both in the battlefield and off it, and what price it could extract from Putin for doing so. It's no secret that Russia would like China to help it out, i.e. bail it out, as it flounders in an economic and military quagmire brought about by its invasion of Ukraine a year ago. International sanctions have restricted, in some cases cut off, Moscow's access to a number of Western markets. And yet the money keeps pouring in. While the ongoing war in Ukraine shows all the signs of turning into a bloody stalemate that could, if it loses, cause seismic political change in Moscow. Against that backdrop, the current meeting between Xi and Putin in its second day today saw the leaders discuss the war in Ukraine and China's proposed peace plan. Unofficially, however, analysts say the presidents are also likely to discuss ways for China to assist Russia without it risking being hit with the Western sanctions itself. Russia reportedly asked Beijing for military and economic assistance early on with its invasion to help wage its war against Ukraine and the West, although both governments publicly denied that. The eye of suspicion is still being cast on Beijing, despite its continuing denials that it could help Moscow with lethal on-field weapons. For many close watchers of Russia and China's deepening relationship, the question then becomes this: what could China want in return for helping Moscow? Well, when geopolitical analysts discuss China, one aspect of Beijing's foreign policy is agreed on fully. China never acts purely out of altruism. There's always a price or perceived price for Beijing for its support or intervention. Well, Xi and Putin are expected to issue a joint statement, as well as to sign potentially other deals related to energy, with analysts saying Beijing could be well looking to access Russian commodities and other resources at a discount. Timothy Ash at Blue Bay Asset Management says she knows Putin is desperate and increasingly dependent on China. If Putin is willing to offer China cut-rate long-term commodity deals, well, all the better. China will take whatever it can get from a weakened Putin. Now, here's something that I wish Melody were here. I know it would get in her craw. So thankfully, she's not tuning in at the moment. Jamie Dimon, chair and CEO of five-time felon J.P. Morgan Chase, the largest bank in the U.S., which is also ranked as the riskiest global bank by its regulators, has been focused elsewhere. Dimon has. Pam and Russ Martin's report in today's Wall Street on Parade newsletter that over the past week, Dimon's publicists have been burning up the phone lines, pushing the narrative that Dimon is some kind of wizard who needs to have a seat at the table to save the banking system, or at least First Republic Bank. Last Thursday, news hit the wire services that Dimon had lined up 11 banks willing to place a combined $30 billion in uninsured deposits into First Republic. Two big-to-fail banks, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Citigroup, and Wells Fargo, each ponied up $5 billion, or two-thirds of that $30 bill. The FDIC caps federal deposit insurance at $250,000 per depositor per bank. The Martins note that taking $5 billion off their bank shareholders' money and throwing it at a regional bank whose stock price is literally collapsing wasn't viewed as the brightest of ideas by the stock market. Last Friday, after that deal was announced, shares of First Republic dropped 32%. Yesterday, it collapsed by another 47%. Today, it's rebounded a good bit with shares up 40% as of early afternoon Eastern time. Now, over the weekend, S&P Global downgraded First Republic's credit rating for a second time in a week to even deeper junk status. Martins believe that the motive behind Dimon's obsession with First Republic, speaking of altruism or the lack thereof, is to use a collapsing regional bank to get Janet Yellen on board to push for a government guarantee on all deposits, insured and uninsured, at all. Emphasis all FDIC banks. They say that by framing this as coming to the rescue of regional banks rather than another bailout of the unaccountable too big to fails on Wall Street, Dimon doesn't have to explain to his compromised board of directors why 69% of both First Republic's and his own bank's deposits were uninsured at year's end. And to be sure, J.P. Morgan's regulatory filing for 12/31/22 shows that it held $1.527 trillion in deposits, of which roughly $1.058 trillion were uninsured. Yes, 69%. The Teflon Bank CEO, Mr. Dimon. Well, a pullback in lending among small banks around the country was already underway before the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank. Now, economists expect to see more tightening. Sorry, borrowers. Stricter lending standards among smaller banks is likely to slow economic growth overall, but the commercial real estate sector, already battered by rising interest rates and half-empty office buildings, is particularly at risk. Big banks get a lot of the attention, but there are, I think, 4,800 banks roughly in the U.S., and the small ones play a large role in particularly local economies. Small and mid-sized banks, defined as domestically chartered banks not among the 25 largest, currently hold 67% of all outstanding commercial real estate loans and almost 38% of loans overall. That's a chunk of change. These small players certainly grease the wheels of the economy in all kinds of ways, particularly in specialized areas and regions of the country. I mean, think Signature Bank's lending to Broadway or SVB's lending to startups. Well, by the end of last year, banks were already pulling back on lending as they saw more deposits head out the door. That's according to Chad Little at CoStar Group. Regular consumers had burned through excess savings and needed money to pay the bills. And some companies, like the tech startups who banked at SVB, were seeing a greater need to access their cash, too. About 40% of loan officers, 40% said they had tightened lending standards in the commercial real estate space during the last quarter of 2022. That's a good chunk. And only about 5% said they were tightening at the end of the previous year. Meanwhile, another huge area of office building financing, the market for commercial mortgage-backed securities, where banks bundle the loans and resell them to investors, is literally seizing up. Sales of these deals were down 85% in February compared to last year, even as the Fed started to unwind their portfolio. The failures of SVB and Signature are likely to accelerate that pullback. Now, Little himself believes the banking sector, which was already limiting its exposure to real estate, may look to restrict lending even further after the recent bank collapses, especially among regional and community banks. But since lending standards were already tight, it's possible the impact of these recent bank failures might indeed be more limited. This probably surfaces first in the most distressed part of the real estate sector, offices known particularly as Class B. Little said those most at risk, companies with floating rate loans whose interest burdens have become increasingly unaffordable, or those with loans scheduled to mature soon. So how will this pullback trickle out to regular everyday Americans and the economy in general? Well, I don't know. I mean, will it make it harder to get car loans and other kind of consumer loans? We shall see. Now, the Fed's rate hiking campaign has brought activity in the residential real estate market to a crawl, we know, but prices have barely budged. In other countries, the impact of higher rates on home prices is way more pronounced, at least according to a new report published by the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Like the Fed, other central banks around the world have fought against this surge of inflation with a flurry of interest rate increases, which have raised mortgage rates, making housing more costly to finance, and of course, driving sale prices lower. The deepest downturns in housing prices are actually in New Zealand and Sweden, two nations that saw surging home prices earlier in the pandemic. And the majority of borrowers in both countries have floating rate mortgages that reset with rising interest rates, which means household finances are put under pressure quickly, forcing some owners to sell. In contrast, the percentage of variable rates in countries like the Netherlands is much lower. The Netherlands and Denmark also have fairly large systems of subsidized public housing, meaning that people who in countries like Sweden might stretch to buy and then be forced to sell, well, they're more insulated from the rate increase. in the home, of course, the uniquely American 30-year fixed rate mortgage, the price impact, at least so far, of the rise in rates has been somewhat muted. Golden handcuffs, on the other hand, mortgages taken out while rates were low incentivize people to hang on to their home rather than trade up to a new one. Bottom line, countries have different systems, and it's hard to say what's better or what's worse. Hey, time for another break. Hang in there with us. We got one more session to go. You're listening to Financial Survival. Don't say
since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time today, welcome back to Financial Survival. Dave Allen here. The offices are open at 1-800-375-4188. Now, to start off this final segment, here's an odd question for you. What do COVID and the Federal Reserve have in common? More to the point, how are catching COVID and how the Fed is handling the economy alike or not? First, COVID. Last Sunday, I started feeling uneasy. I had this dry, hacking cough that kept getting worse and worse as the new week began. Add to it a low-grade fever, no taste or smell, and an intense sense of fatigue. By Wednesday, I struggled to open my eyes, much less attempt another day of productive work. So I took the at-home swab test, and voila, it was positive for good old C-19. Well, I immediately called my doctor, who said a confirmation test wasn't necessary because of the home test's general accuracy. But she did ask me if I wanted a prescription for Paxlovid or other treatment. And after telling me the pros and cons and pointing out that I was nearing the end of the period of these drugs' efficacies, I decided to take a pass and just write it out. I mean, after all, I had taken, for better or for worse, all the recommended vaccinations and what have you over the past 2 years, plus I felt my body just needed a break from any more foreign chemicals. In short, I consciously decided it was time to sit back and let this ugly thing take the rest of its natural course, believing that I had done my best to prepare for this possibility and limit its worst-case scenario. Well, the Fed would be well advised to heed this same kind of restraint, I think, by pausing its rate hikes and its quantitative tightening program, too, and let the results of their past deeds play out before deciding what additional actions are necessary. Now, that's how my experience with COVID would be alike or similar to how the Fed could be handling the economy. Unfortunately, I fear the Fed as an institution is not geared for such inertia, however transitory it might be. Ironically, as Neil Irwin writes, a few problem-plagued regional U.S. banks could be on the verge of accomplishing what the Fed's been unable to do since last March, slow down the economy in a meaningful way. Felix Salmon points out that part of the reason rate hikes haven't slowed the economy over the past year is that while borrowing costs have been higher, credit has mostly remained readily available. And although the Fed's balance sheet of treasuries and mortgage-backed securities, valued at $8.965 trillion at its peak last April, has begun to fall under QT, it still holds $8.34 trillion as of a little over a week ago. That's a drop of just 6%. Now, that's likely why, Salmon says, mortgage rates have increased more than treasury yields over the past year, causing a huge downturn in the housing market. Rising rates have also caused the value of the Fed's own balance sheet to lose value, making it likely the Fed won't be able to send the U.S. Treasury its usual $100 billion annual profit. Cue the congressional outrage. Some economists say that even before last week's shock, bank lending had begun to tighten to levels usually seen in times leading up to recessions. The two-year Treasury yield, which was 5.06% just 8 days ago, was at 3.93 last Thursday and 3.875 a day later. That, Salmon warns, implies that the Fed will soon be cutting its target rate from the current level, something it normally does only if there's clear evidence of economic deterioration and falling inflation. Now, Irwin and Courtney Brown point out that the conundrum facing the Fed is that its anti-inflation tools work at cross purposes with the ones it uses to prevent a financial crisis. For example, pushing ahead with more interest rate hikes and balance sheet shrinkage might be good for further reducing inflation, but at the same time, those actions could very well further destabilize the financial system further. Plus, as of Wednesday, the Fed had also extended $143 billion to support the deposit guarantees at Silicon Valley and Signature Banks, and another $12 billion extended in a new lending program announced on Sunday. Just like a patient showing some restraint in turning down their doc's offers for Paxlovid, the Fed needs to take a breather from both rate hikes and QT, just for a meeting cycle or two. Let the economy catch up to what they've already done. And last today, our American Survival newsletter has hit the streets. It features Doug Nolan's credit bubble bulletin blog called Fire, and Apothecary Herb's Wendy Wilson's food for thought on the next disease outbreak. And in addition to Melody's weekly financial market recap, I have an article on the hopes and perils of spring. Another bank down. How many more to go? Last week was Silicon Valley and Signature Banks down with an almost gone to First Republic. And now, too big to fail Credit Suisse almost failed this past weekend. Instead, fellow Swiss bank UBS is buying its former rival for negative $14 billion. Say what? Yes, as I mentioned last segment, UBS is paying $3.2 billion to Credit Suisse shareholders, but only because Swiss banking regulators are eliminating $17.2 billion of the bank's liabilities, leaving its bondholders with nothing but worthless paper, literally cents on the dollar. Global regulators have determined that 30 mega banks, global systemically important banks, G-SIBs as they're known, are just too big to fail. I mean, you know the usual suspects, Citibank, JP Morgan Chase here in the U.S., Deutsche Bank, UBS, and the like overseas. And because of their designation as G-SIBs, they operate under stricter capital standards and regulatory scrutiny than their smaller peers. Nevertheless, with Credit Suisse propped up as exhibit number one, they can still end up being worth a negative amount of money. Emily Peck and Matt Phillips wrote recently that in the normal world of mergers and acquisitions, that wouldn't be possible. They say bondholders are senior to shareholders, meaning that they get paid first, and only once they're paid out in full do shareholders get anything. In the real world of rescuing, i.e. bailing out a too-big-to-fail bank, however, such niceties can end up being sacrificed for the sake of managing to get a deal done. Wow. Turns out that senior UBS management and its major shareholders didn't particularly want to buy Credit Suisse, while Credit Suisse management and shareholders reportedly didn't want to be caught holding an empty, worthless bank. It's unlikely this deal would have gotten shareholder approval from either side, which is one reason why Swiss authorities changed the law to permit the deal. The interests of international financial stability ended up overriding the interests of shareholders. Justice prevails, right? Well, kinda, or something like that. Swiss regulators sort of forced the two banks together. Through Credit Suisse shareholders, a $3.2 billion bone, and then zeroed out a bunch of junior contingent convertible bonds that are supposed to convert into equity when a bank gets into trouble. Well, Credit Suisse shareholders ended up losing about $17 billion in equity over the past year. At that point, Peck and Phillips point out there wasn't another $17 billion left to lose, so the next tier up had to take a hit. In the interest of expedience, it was easier to just zero out the convertible bonds and leave shareholders with, well, $3.2 billion than it would have been to convert them to equity and then pay them out at pennies on the dollar. Apparently, just finding a conversion price would have been an incredibly big deal. Bank balance sheets comprise one pile of assets offsetting another pile of liabilities. Shareholders only own the slice in between, which in the case of Credit Suisse was nothing. When a bank is failing, they generally have no say in what happens to it. The convertible bondholders have more reason to feel betrayed, but they were going to lose most of their money anyway. And besides, convertible bonds are supposed to behave like equity in a crisis. In that sense, it shouldn't have come as a complete surprise that they've been wiped out to keep Credit Suisse alive. We're now embedded as part of a new UBS. Well, while this was going on, the world's leading central banks jointly announced new action intended to keep U.S. dollars flowing through the global banking system, returning to a tool used in past financial crises. Neil Irwin reports that the Fed, the European Central Bank, the Bank of England, the Bank of Canada, Bank of Japan, and Swiss National Bank all spent their Sunday evenings trying to make dollar swap lines more readily available. As Irwin points out, in stressful financial times, much like these, banks around the globe often are more reluctant to lend dollars to each other, creating additional tightening of global credit. Swap lines, which were used extensively during the Great Recession and again in the early days of the pandemic in 2020, allow overseas central banks to access dollars directly from the Fed. Then in turn, they make dollar loans to their own domestic banks. The Fed essentially becomes a global lender of last resort. Well, notably, these swap lines are now part of a standing liquidity arrangement between the Fed and major foreign banks. But Sunday night's announcement is aimed at increasing the line's effectiveness by making the liquidity available again daily instead of just weekly. The move comes after UBS took over Credit Suisse with substantial financial guarantees from the Swiss government and its central bank earlier yesterday. Irwin says it's a sure sign of the severity of the risk that global central banks see from the growing strains in the global banking system since SVB imploded 9 days ago, which brings us to the FDIC guarantee. Again, under federal law, the FDIC guarantees customer bank deposits up to $250,000 per bank. Emily Peck says it's a figure most of us weren't thinking about until 10 days ago, when regulators guaranteed all customer deposits at two failed banks, even those above $250,000. Now the water cooler talk, or kitchen table for those remote workers, is debating whether the FDIC limit, which hasn't been raised since 2008, needs to be increased or abolished altogether. Over the weekend, four different members of Congress said they'd consider raising the limit. Separately, a coalition of mid-sized banks is asking the FDIC to insure all deposits for at least 2 years. Regulators certainly ruffled some feathers when they recently decided to protect all depositors at SVB and Signature Bank, aiming to stem a serious risk of flight from the financial system. Peck argues that on one hand, their actions sent the message that if you deposit more than $250K at an important enough bank, it'll be safe. On the other hand, she points out, no one has actually said that. The limit still exists, and uninsured deposits are still technically uninsured. Perhaps more importantly, Peck says it's unclear what makes a bank important enough. As she points out, First Republic Bank, SVB's similarly sized peer, continued to experience withdrawal of uninsured deposits after SVB's rescue. So what are we left with other than a ton of confusion? At this point, the $250,000 cap is illusory, writes Lev Menand and Morgan Ricks in a piece for the Washington Post. They argue that the limit should just be scrapped. Otherwise, they add, the official cap remaining in place means that much of the nation's money is simply unsound and unstable, an ever-present sword of Damocles hanging over the U.S. economy. Happy spring, ladies and gentlemen. Do you know the status of your bank's balance sheet? That's all the time for today's program. I'll return on Thursday. Butch will be here tomorrow, along with Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs. I'm Dave Allen. It's been a lot of fun today. Thanks, as always, to our producer, Todd, for keeping us rocking and rolling. And to you, our loyal listeners, for tuning into Financial Survival. Please be safe out there. Have a good night. Bye-bye. Later.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad. I got you.